The following Free School University program was originally broadcast on October 3rd on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR.FM. You should also check out our February 15th show on Money, Debt, and the Federal Reserve Bank, which was podcast on September 22nd, and the companion show on the federal budget, which was broadcast Wednesday, October 10th, and will be podcast next week. Welcome to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. I'm David Knutnan, your host, and tonight's special guest is Arjun Jayadev. This is Arjun's second appearance on FSU program. He's an assistant professor at UMass Boston, where he focuses on things like international economics, economics of distribution, development, political economy, macroeconomic dynamics, and the economics of power. Last time he was on the show, he was talking with us about money and banking and monetary policy. Today we're going to talk about the other major tool of economic policy. We're going to talk about fiscal policy. So the last time you're on the show, Arjun, we realized that economists think about money in very different ways than most of us probably do. And this time I think we're going to find out that economists think differently about things like spending and debt and stuff like that, I would imagine. We should probably start with the basics. I mean, the idea of fiscal policy, as I understand it, is basically the government can use spending or taxation not just in order to fund useful programs, but actually for their effects on the economy. Is that basically right?
That's right. So first I should say thanks very much for having me back. It's actually fun to be back, and I'm glad that this
program is going on. And I should have said welcome to the show, but I know
that's fine. So that's right. I think it's very important and interesting to make a distinction between two sorts of use of government policy, specifically government spending or government taxation. One is for what we might think of as purely providing social services that we all care about, right? Mm-hmm. And we know and love many of them. And then there is another reason why governments sometimes spend more or spend less or tax more or tax less. And that is typically when there is a downswing in the economy, which is to say that there's not enough demand for goods and services in the economy. The government can step in and provide that demand. This is what is often called fiscal policy, or rather expansionary fiscal policy. And you also have something called contractionary fiscal policy, when governments spend less. And that typically happens in the upswing. At least that is what the classic textbook version of what fiscal policy is suggests. So it's important to make these two distinctions, because quite often when we hear debates about government, there's a lot of things get melded together. Mm-hmm. How big should government be? What is government debt? What are government deficits? Mm-hmm. Should government be spending now or not be spending now? And all of these get melded together in a kind of unhelpful way. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to keep these distinctions. Mm-hmm.
The grandfather of fiscal policy was John Maynard Keynes, right? I mean, so this the type of economics that involves using fiscal policy or recommending using is often called Keynesianism. Is that correct?
Go ahead. There's many. Of course, the idea of using government spending to boost the economy was not invented by Keynes. It was given a lot more theoretical clarity by Keynes. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've had governments for centuries spending more especially in medieval kingdoms. You'd actually have periods in which when there was some sort of downturn in economic activities, the kingdom would spend. Right, that's been known, but really you're right that theoretically the foundations of fiscal policy started around in the 1930s, when it became clear that the typical tool by which one could conceive of expanding economic activity, which is to increase money supply, was not working, and that you needed something else. And that is kind of the moment in the 30s in which fiscal policy was I wouldn't say invented, but certainly fiscal policy was given a strong role in economic management.
I'm distracted, Arjuna, momentarily because I moved his mic.
But that's fine.
So the other thing I had when you were speaking is you used the word demand, and that was really a key element in Keynes's theory, wasn't it? Downswings in the economy are really best described as a lack of effective demand.
Yes, that's exactly right, and I think this is extremely important to remember, and I think it's extremely important to remember because it really helps us understand this particular recession and the moment we're going through. There's two reasons for which economic activity slows down. One obvious reason is that people aren't buying enough goods and services, and there's too many people providing the goods and services, and so something's got to give, right? That is what we might call insufficient demand. The other reason is that for whatever reason, the supply in the economy contracts. And let's say there's an oil shock or prices go up and companies realize that they can't make the same margins that they were going to make and they cut back on their supply. And that's another kind of way in which you have recessions. But I think it's very important to realize that in this particular recession, and actually many recessions, the leading problem was a lack of effective demand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this recession, it's extremely clear why that is the case. Part of the reason I find the debates in economics very frustrating.
We should probably back up a little bit and explain the term effective demand.
Okay, so effective demand is...
demand is when people want stuff, but what makes demand effective?
Well, okay, so I think there's sometimes... one needs to be a little bit careful with language. It's not effective in the sense of it has an effect. It's effective as in think about in effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sense in which the term is being used. It means... the aggregate of all the demand in the economy for goods and services, whether it comes from households or governments or businesses, that's what you call effective demand. And sometimes you call it aggregate demand.
Okay. But I guess what I was trying to get at, maybe I misunderstood the term myself, but because people can, if most people think about demand, they might think about, well, I want stuff.
Okay.
But then they may also think, but I can't go out and buy it because I'm short of money this week.
Right.
So in order for demand to be effective economically, people actually have to have the money to go out and buy the things that they want, right?
Yes, I don't think that's the way that Keynes really used the term mm-hmm. effective demand, but that links in some sense to the ideas of effective demand. What you're saying is there are particular periods of time in which households suddenly find that they're short of their desired demand,
mm-hmm.
right? They're short in terms of their the actual income that they have to satisfy the desired demand,
right?
And yes.
So you really need a new car, but you just can't get it because you can't come up with the cash.
Right. So that is another way in which you can talk about.
So in order for demand to be able to stimulate the economy, the people actually have to have the money to go out and buy the stuff that they need.
So that's right. So for them to reach their level of desired demand, that is what they would need.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important, just to back up a little bit, I think it's important to make a distinction between aggregate demand and demand by particular consumers and whether it's households or firms, because what really is important for the macroeconomy is the total demand in the economy, right? It doesn't really matter where it's coming from, and in that sense, that is, I think, the key Keynesian insight, right? That if one side of the market demanding goods and services pulls back, it will cause a recession unless something else steps up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the key point here.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what order I want to ask things in because I got a lot of things I want to ask you about. But I guess since we're talking about demand, that kind of suggests the whole question of I mean, we've heard a lot since Ronald Reagan years about supply-side economics, and supply-side economics is basically what you were saying about producers, that, you know, you can have an economic problem because for some reason production isn't there. And I guess the theory of supply-side economics says that it's all of the producers. So the problem is the producers aren't producing for some reason, so you have to give producers more money, basically, so that they'll spend more money on making stuff, and that will stimulate the economy.
That's right. And so typically the Reagan policy was to cut tax rates on what now is euphemistically called wealth creators, but I would just say the rich, yeah. Right? And the idea there is that they are able to invest more, mm-hmm. or rather earn more on their investments, and therefore will invest more. Now, it's a very dubious proposition in terms of in many ways. But holding that aside, let's assume that was a possible reason for a recession, right? Mm-hmm. Or this recession. Let's assume that you have two theories. One theory says that this recession is occurring because tax rates are too high on businesses, and another theory says this recession is occurring because there's not enough demand in the economy, right? We can talk about this a little bit more, and I would like to, but it's very clear that there's much more evidence for the latter, that is to say that it is a demand-led recession rather than a recession that is occurring.
What kind of evidence? Just
all right, so very simple sort of evidence. So very simple sort of evidence that you would take a look at. What is happening to consumption, right? What is happening to household expenditure? Very simple sort of figures like that. In 2008, what you saw was an enormous decrease in household wealth. You saw the stock market crash, and you saw the housing value crash as well. Mm-hmm. It was actually a loss of $12 trillion in terms of net worth for households, right? Mm-hmm. In the face of this huge shock, what are households going to do? Are they going to consume more? Or are they going to save more? And you find that they save more, which is fairly obvious, right? You suddenly realize that your house is not worth so much. You thought you'd saved enough for retirement, but your stocks are not doing well. Mm. The response is to save.
There was also, of course, the shock created a lot of unemployment, so all of a sudden people's incomes were dropping.
Yes,
also.
So they're linked, right? So yeah. Exactly. So what happens? You have this really vicious cycle. So you have this shock, you create a little unemployment, but wealth goes down a lot, so consumption goes down a lot. Mm-hmm. Right? Once consumption goes down
then
a lot,
then you get layoffs.
Then you get layoffs. Now suddenly there are more people who are laid off, and those people are suddenly saying, hey, I need to cut back on my consumption and save because I don't have a job at the moment. Mm-hmm. And you can see how this can be a vicious cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So that, in effect, is what happened in the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. You had consumption, household expenditure and consumption declining, primarily because of reduction in wealth, and that happened because of the financial crisis, and you had this vicious cycle all the way down. Now, there's many reasons to believe that it was that rather than higher taxes, or a high level of taxes. Why? Because taxes were just cut in the previous years. Right, so there's no reason to believe that was the thing that caused, or the lack of low taxes on the rich caused the recession. And it's a very peculiar sort of logic which says that we need to cut taxes on the rich now because you will somehow create wealth, when it becomes extremely clear, even if the rich were to spend more and therefore build more factories and so on, there would be no one buying their goods and services. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's really a demand side phenomenon.
I mean, it's interesting to me. I mean, in principle, either cutting taxes or government spending is fiscal stimulus, right? Because it puts more money in people's hands. So in that sense, it seems like. Now, I don't think this is true, but I could see how you could see that. It's cutting taxes on the rich is also Keynesianism, because they'll have more money, so they'll spend more money. But I guess that leads me to ask, is it really true that it doesn't make, I mean, does it make any difference what the government spends money on, or what sectors the government cuts taxes on? I mean, Keynes famously said that the government could just hire people to bury money and hire other people to dig it up, right?
Right.
But is it really, are there better and worse types of stimulus, I guess?
I think it certainly is clear that there are probably better and worse sorts of stimulus. I think you asked two questions. The first question was to do with is tax cutting, even on the rich, Keynesian in some sense? And the answer is yes. I mean, the sense, if to the small extent that there would be increased consumption by the rich, you would actually find that there should be an increase in demand. Now, the interesting part is you could probably cut taxes on the middle class and the poor, and the effect on demand would be much larger. Right? So in that sense, it seems like a no-brainer, and there's a reason why it's a no-brainer, that cutting taxes on the middle and the poor has a bigger effect on demand. The simple reason is that the poor and the middle class spend more out of every dollar that they have. Mm-hmm. The rich save more. Mm-hmm. So if you give them an extra dollar, they'll save more of that mm-hmm. dollar. If you give a poorer person more of a dollar in terms of tax saving, they'll spend more of it.
Right.
And so in that sense, in terms of purely, without talking about the morals of who we give tax cuts to, in purely a demand, in purely kind of evaluating what the demand effect is, it's very clear that the cutting taxes on the poor and the middle class is a better solution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other question that you asked was about government spending, right? And it's extremely, this is important because government spending is often given a bad rap because I think really vilification of government in general. But what I want to suggest is that there are many sorts of government expenditure which have extremely valuable long-term growth implications. I'd like to give you an example of this. On Saturday, I was on Saturday I was at a Bruce Springsteen concert in New Jersey, right? And we were trying to cross over from Brooklyn into New Jersey in the early evening. And if you've tried to do that, you know it's a nightmare. It took us 2 hours to get 8 miles or 12 miles. And you also know that there was a plan to build another tunnel between New Jersey and New York, and it was vetoed by Chris Christie, who was the governor of New Jersey, because he said we should not be spending so much, we should tighten our belts and so on. Right? Now, at the same time, while coming into New York, I crossed by the Triborough Bridge. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think when the Triborough Bridge was built. It was built, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, as part of the great expansions uh-huh. of during the New Deal and afterwards. Uh-huh. Just look at the amount of increased productivity that's got. It's hard to even calculate how much increased productivity has been generated to the New York City economy by that
right.
over the years, because of the amount of flows of people and goods and services that were possible.
Uh-huh.
And so when you think about it in the long-term perspectives, there are some sorts of government expenditure, things like infrastructure,
uh-huh.
which have enormous long-term implications, even if they're short-term costs.
Uh-huh.
Now, Chris Christie didn't see that.
Uh-huh.
Of course, FDR and others saw that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the kind of decisions one has to make when one's thinking about government spending. What has long-term potential to increase the productivity and the welfare of the economy,
uh-huh.
and what doesn't?
Uh-huh.
Now, your Keynes quote that you provide, it is true that you could spend on anything and still get incomes.
Uh-huh.
But of course, I mean, Keynes meant that ironically, right? He didn't really mean that.
No.
Though some of his detractors really thought he meant that. But he was just saying that even if you did that, you'd have an increase in demand, but there are probably better things you can spend it on.
Keynes was an economist with a sense of humor, which
very
is
much
somewhat,
so, yeah.
somewhat dangerous in right, the profession,
exactly.
I think.
Exactly. With your understated British humor, it's particularly hard.
I guess when we're talking about these effects, I don't know if this is related or not to what to the idea of spending on infrastructure versus spending on some other things, but I was thinking, when the government spends money to stimulate the economy, the effect, it's not a one-to-one effect, right? I mean, the government hopes to get more. Is something called the multiplier, is that right. correct? I mean, can you explain that a little bit?
So this is a controversial topic, right? Mm-hmm. Because we are not 100% sure about the size of the multiplier. Let me tell you a little bit first about what the idea of the multiplier is. Mm-hmm. The idea of the multiplier is fairly simple. It's the idea that suppose I was to spend $10 and that everyone spends, say, $8 out of every income that every dollar of income that they get. Mm-hmm. Suppose I was to spend $10 and on buying some sort of services from you. Mm-hmm. You now have $10 that you didn't have before. And now you can spend, you would spend $8 of that. Mm-hmm. Right? So once you spend the $8 of that, it becomes the income to someone else. Mm-hmm. And they would spend 8 out of every... 80 cents out of every dollar for that, or $6.40 out of the $80. And if you add those up, you'd actually get much more income than the original $10. In fact, you get, as it turns out, $50. Oh, right? Wow. So that in this particular instance, the multiplier is 5. For my original $10, I generated economic activity of $50. Mm-hmm. That's what the multiplier means. How much more additional output is generated by an increase in expenditure, mm-hmm. what is sometimes called autonomous expenditure. Now, there are reasons that people feel uncomfortable with this. They would say, hey, where did this money come from? The original $10, right? Did it not take away from some other activity that would have been the case? Right. So that is actually a reasonable question. It was a question that was asked by David Ricardo many, even before Keynes, obviously. Mm-hmm. He asked this question, if governments spend on one side, isn't it the case that actually they're preventing that money from going to the other, to something else that it could have gone to? And doesn't it turn out to be a wash in the end? Now, it turns out that it turns out that that's not the case in a depressed economy, obviously, because that money is not going anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So a multiplier is the most effective in a depressed economy, mm-hmm. right? So the debates around the multiplier...
Because people weren't... That money wasn't going to be spent.
That money wasn't going to be spent, exactly. It's just sitting there.
The people that have money don't have anything to spend it on because...
Yeah. Exactly. Or don't desire to spend it on anything else. And therefore, in this case, it's not you're not losing out on that money, right? You're not losing out on the other flow of income that you could have got. You're actually generating more jobs. So that's the notion of the multiplier. And there's been a lot of testing of the size of the multiplier using very different techniques. You can imagine it's actually difficult to figure out the counterfactual, which is someone else would have spent the money versus what happened when the government spends the money and so on. And the general idea is that the multiplier is
actually... It's kind of hard to do controlled experiments.
Exactly. It's hard to do controlled experiments, but there are some clever ways in which you can do it. And there have been a lot of studies about this which suggest that the multiplier is above one, mm-hmm. which is to say that you get more bang for the buck than just simply spending on that one, that original $10. And it ranges between 1 and 2.
So it's not, doesn't get up to 5.
No, it never gets up to
that's
5.
Too bad.
Yeah, that's too bad. That's exactly right, yeah.
I guess the other obvious question is the link between fiscal policy and debt and deficits. And if you're spending money in a recession and you don't want to raise taxes because that's contractionary, but you want to spend money because that's expansionary,
yeah.
and you want the economy to expand because it's contracting. Then you have to borrow money to do that, basically. The government has to borrow money. And why isn't that a bad thing? I guess maybe we should start, since this is, we can't assume that everybody knows everything. Start by explaining the difference between the deficit and the debt.
Okay. So this is actually a good place to start. So every year the government takes in some money and it spends some money, right? So let's just assume that we're starting at 1 year. This is a new country, and the government spends $1,000 and only takes in $800 in that year, right? The deficit in that year is $200, mm-hmm. which is that the difference between government spending and its taxation. Let's assume in year two, it does the same thing, right? The next year does the same. It spends $1,000 and it raises only $200 in tax revenue. Mm-hmm. Now, the debt refers to the accumulated deficits, right? So, originally you had $200 in the first year, and in the second year you also have $200. Mm-hmm. So, the debt now is $400, while mm-hmm. the deficit in each year is $200. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about the U.S. debt, we're talking about the sum total of all the deficits that the U.S. has accumulated.
Okay, so basically the debt is all the money that you spent and haven't paid back yet, accumulated.
Yeah, exactly.
And the deficit is just the money you spend over your income in any given year.
That's exactly right. So that's right. Now, the question that you had asked, I think, was about government spending and fiscal policy in a depressed economy, and whether this will increase the debt and what are the implications of that.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Sure.
So I think this is a very important question, because in some sense there is debt fetishism in the US. You know, if you go to Times Square, you'll see this debt clock, and you know, it's a big number without any context. So I think it's important to realize that in a depressed economy, you actually expect deficits to go up and the debt to go up for mm-hmm. two reasons. Mm-hmm. One, people don't have jobs, and so they don't have incomes, and so they don't pay taxes. Just purely on the basis of that, you would expect the deficit to go up, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing you would want to happen is you would want the government to be spending more in order to make up, as we had said, for lost demand, right? So on one hand, you have government expenditure increasing and you have tax revenue decreasing, right? And most of the increase in the debt in the U.S. has happened because tax revenue has decreased, not because government spending has increased, right? Not because government spending has increased. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, you see this figure. Obama has added $5 trillion to the debt. Mm-hmm. My own response to that would be, he's not added enough to the debt. Mm-hmm. He should have actually been spending a lot more, even if tax revenues were lower. Why is this the case? Because you would have gotten out, hopefully, of the recession earlier. You'd have had more incomes for people, and they would be spending, therefore they would be able to pay more taxes, and you'd actually see a decline in the debt rather than an increase in the debt. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think there's been a lot of debate among economists. What has happened to debt? What is the reason for the increases in debt? And what are the implications of this for the health of the U.S. economy?
I mean, you're talking about, I think I heard you say that a lot of the increase in debt is actually more due to low tax revenue than it is to increase government spending. But in fact, a lot of the people that spend a lot of time complaining about the debt are also always pushing cutting taxes, especially on the wealthy. So isn't that a kind of a hypocritical argument?
So yes, I mean, I think it's very clear that it's an argument in bad faith, right? I mean, if you really wanted to cut the government debt, you would raise taxes. That's one way to do it. And some conservatives actually believe that's the case, that this is the time that you actually have to raise taxes, not cut taxes. Mm-hmm. But they would argue, in addition to that, that you also want to reduce government spending, mm-hmm. which is another way to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this has very serious class consequences, right? Because government spending, to the extent that it supports middle class and poorer people, is a benefit to them. And therefore, you're actually taking away a benefit to them mm-hmm. from this. Now, a conservative argument would be, that's okay. We want less total government involvement, which is less government spending overall. And so you'd actually need to raise less taxes in the future in order to support that kind mm-hmm. of spending.
Well, this is what what you seem to be describing is another word we hear in the news all the time, which is austerity, right? I mean, this is the idea.
Yeah.
Somehow we slash government spending, we slash programs, and that's the way to get us out of the out of a bad economy, but it doesn't seem to be working very well.
Yes, so this is actually a very funny set of arguments. Paul Krugman has a term for the people who speak like this. He calls them Austerians, right? And I think it's a nice term. So the claim is the only way to cut the deficit and to increase growth is to induce a lot of austerity, which is to cut back on government programs very sharply. And the major argument that is made, people would ask, why the hell should you expect demand to grow if you cut government expenditure? And the main argument that is made is, what it will do is will make investors more confident. Right? It'll make investors more confident that the government expenditure is declining, that the government is in charge of its debt, and therefore they will spend more. This is the idea. It's got a kind of oxymoronic expression. It's called expansionary austerity. And this for whatever reason, took root among a lot of policymakers in across the world in the last 2 to 3 years. And they tried it. Most notably in Britain, right? Most notably, I say, because it's the most similar to the US in having its own currency, in having a very similar trajectory, a housing crisis, and so on. Britain originally was recovering when the government, under the Labour government, there was expenditure. It's now undergoing a double-dip recession. What is that doing to tax revenues? It's cutting it further. What's that doing to the debt? It's increasing it. So the absolute opposite of the Austerians' claims is occurring, and rather very Keynesian effects are occurring. If you try to cut during a recession, you're going to worsen the recession. So now you'll see in the news, everyone is all the people who originally said it would work across the world point to Latvia. Of all countries, Latvia is now supposed to be the role model for the rest of the world, because they actually did cut expenditure and did see growth. If you take a look at Latvia, they're not anywhere near the level of growth they were before this. It's true that they're growing relative to two, 3 years ago, but it's at the cost of 50% unemployment. 50% wow. Open unemployment among the
50%?
50.
That's like the official rate?
The official rate is 50% unemployment among the youth, right?
Among youth.
I think the if you take the overall population, it's well in the 20s. Right? You have major social dislocation, huge migration. A survey was done in Latvia saying, how many people would like to migrate? A full third of the country said they want to migrate from Latvia. So it's possible you can cut, but you would be imposing a lot of misery on your citizens. You can cut expenditure.
You know, it occurs to me, Keynes actually, I think, thought that investor confidence was important too. But he thought that investors would be confident if they thought demand would be strong in the future. So he thought that actually expanding demand was the key to investor confidence.
Yeah.
It does occur to me that he was thinking about kind of a different class of investor. He was thinking about maybe people that were a little bit closer to the actual production end, you know, factory owners and people who were investing directly in factories and directly in production of goods and services, whereas now when we talk about investors, we're talking about the finance industry, aren't we? Or people who really think of nothing but, you know, moving paper from one place to another.
That's right. So there's two things in your question. There are two kind of elements in your question. The first is whether confidence depends on demand. And here's the interesting thing. Take a look at small business surveys. You know, we always see people saying we care about small business. Typically, the Republican Party says we support small business. Take a look at their surveys of confidence and surveys of what is the biggest problem for them. And you'll see, and you know what the number one answer is? Lack of sales.
Lack of demand. Lack of customers, yep.
Lack of demand. They don't care. It's not Obamacare. It's not high interest rates. None of those. It's demand. Right? That's a very clear signal. If people... I mean, it's kind of foolish to ignore the business people saying we want there to be more demand. That's the biggest problem. And if you tell them, no, it's actually Obamacare. And they know what the problems are that they're facing, right?
I mean, the basic idea behind that pushing demand is that it doesn't make any difference how much money an investor has if you have no one to sell the products to, because why would you invest?
Exactly. So you see now, firms have huge amounts of cash in there. They have a lot of ability to spend at the moment, but they're not. And why is the well, they're now starting to spend a little bit more. But why is it the case that for so many years between 2008 and 2011, they weren't spending that cash? Well, what was the point of making all these wonderful products if households are not buying?
Right.
It's kind of foolish.
It doesn't make any sense to make them and have them sit on the shelf.
Exactly. Right. And so it's absolutely right that confidence depends a lot on demand. And that's a very key indicator. Now, the second question that you asked was actually somewhat, I think, slightly orthogonal but very linked, which is the idea of what is the definition of an investor when we talk about investment now. And it is true that in the U.S. in the last 20 to 25 years, a lot of if you want to call it the key industry has moved from being a production or manufacturing industry to the financial industry. And so one could very much understand a lot of elite government policy trying to, or elites thinking about government policy, rather not elite government policy, but elites thinking about government policy as trying to see what's in the interests of the financial sector. Right? I think those are two different things, right? So in this particular case, I think it is in the interest of the financial sector to be seeing really a very sharp increase in demand, right? But the way that they prefer to see that is in ways through, say, monetary policy, which affects the stock market, so their assets go up, rather than seeing direct government expenditure. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing, these kind of battles of which is the appropriate policy to use and so on.
Mm-hmm. It's often, maybe this may be my naive thinking, but it's often occurred to me that if you give rich people too much money, the stock market is going to tend to go up, whether it's really producing anything or not, any rate, because you can only spend so much money on yachts, and what are you going to do with the rest of the money? Well, all you can really do if you've got too much of it is buy securities from some other rich person, and that tends to inflate security prices.
So it's possible. I mean, there are interestingly enough, there's one or two models, interestingly enough, by the IMF, which is going to be published.
Not usually thought of as one of the more liberal or radical organizations in the world.
But this actually very, very interesting economist called Michael Kumhoff from the IMF has been pointing to income inequality leading to financial bubbles and really creating crises. Yeah. And so, it's not just naive thinking, as you kind of too modestly put it.
I'm going to actually pause where I'm a little behind schedule here. I should have done this already, but I want to pause for a quick station identification.
Okay.
And remind people that they are listening to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR.FM, on your internet browser. And I'd also like to urge you to support your local Occupy Boston Radio station. Because we need your support. Go to OBR.FM and click on the link that says donate. Your donation will help make sure we have equipment to broadcast on and studio space to broadcast from. Don't let the voice of the 99% go silent. Support OBR today. Now back to Arjun Jayadev, and we're talking about fiscal policy. And I just wanted to ask, I mean, the U.S. has had, compared to Britain, compared to what you're describing, has had a much more expansionary policy, both monetary and fiscal, right? I mean, the Federal Reserve has also been has kept interest rates very low, has kept the money supply quite liberal. We talked about fiscal policy, I mean, monetary policy a little bit the last time you were on, but the Federal Reserve has tried to make sure there's a lot of money available. And Obama did try a fairly large stimulus, maybe not enough, according to some people, including, I guess I'm inclined to think it wasn't enough. But when you talk about what, you know, that England is going through a double dip recession, And I mean, I don't know, I sort of feel like I wish it had happened a little bit earlier, but I'm beginning to feel like maybe we're actually starting to see something like real recovery now. This is my intuitive. This is probably more based on my own business and the fact that I see construction going on all around me in Massachusetts than anything else. But I guess what I'm getting at is, would it be fair to say that Obama's policy actually worked, the U.S. policy actually worked pretty well, comparatively speaking, anyway?
Certainly. So this is always the difficult. This is the difficulty of having to fight a counterfactual, right? So one of the things that you hear about unemployment in the U.S. is the fact that it is stubbornly over 8%. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the employment. It's you're adding jobs, but really not fast enough to make a big dent on the unemployment rate. And these are true things. Now, one doesn't conclude from that the stimulus didn't work. Why is that the case? The obvious reason is that when people start to make projections of how much stimulus was needed, they had no clear idea about how deep the hole was. Mm-hmm. Right? When these projections were being made in 2008, 2009... Forget the bailout. We're not talking about the bailout. We're talking about purely the stimulus.
Right.
You saw $12 trillion, as I said, $12 trillion decrease in wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Purely just to replace the amount of consumption that would have come out of that $12 trillion of wealth, you could have been speaking about $600-800 billion that would have been needed just to make up for that.
What was the size of the stimulus, I thought? Wasn't it about $700 billion?
Yes, but I'm saying, so only to make up for the loss
lost
in...
The lost expenditure
lost
just
expenditure,
from that
just
loss
from
of
consumption,
yeah.
Not from anything else.
Right.
That was sufficient, huh. Right? But in terms of investment, in terms of all the other sorts of expenditure that uh-huh. you would expect to have in the economy, which would not have the... there was not enough to cover that.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's the first point. So... one could reasonably say that you were on track for a 15-16% unemployment rate, right? 12-15. Who knows the actual number that would have been the case? And it is true that it arrested the slide. The stimulus did arrest the slide.
Mm-hmm.
My guess, and it's just a guess, is that if it was larger, it would have started the rebound earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the case that the U.S. has not gone back into a double dip recession. Right, it is the case that there's been an increase in output and activity. It is also the case it's not been fast enough, and we would like it to be faster, but that's not happened. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can look at it as a glass half full or a glass half empty. On the other hand, you don't have a double dip recession, and that's really important to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I have to say, I mean, when you look at what the debates around the stimulus and so on, a lot of people were calling for very large stimulus packages, mm-hmm. But it seemed very clear that this was the only one that was politically feasible.
Right.
So having noted that,
it was a hard enough fight to get that $700
yes,
billion.
Yes, it was $700, $800, whatever it was, yeah. exactly, the different figures that come with it. It was a hard fight. And now since 2010, it just became impossible.
Hmm.
Right, so in that sense, I do feel that
because of the midterm elections, because of the
and there's a
Tea Partiers,
exactly.
anti-spend Tea Partiers gained seats.
Yeah, and that was simply not politically feasible. Now one can hope that whoever comes into power will actually have to continue the policy of running deficits, because it's very clear that if you don't run deficits and you try to cut expenditures, as happened with Britain, and you can't have a better experiment than that,
mm-hmm.
you know, two very similar sorts of trajectories, you actually had a double dip recession in England, and you didn't have that here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope that whoever comes into power doesn't feel the need to start cutting expenditure straight away.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's been in the headlines lately is, you know, Romney has been calling for a cap on government spending that as a percentage of GDP. GDP is basically the total sum of all economic activity, right, essentially. Yeah. It's an easy way to think of it. So he's saying, he's calling for government spending not to exceed 20%. I think it's a little higher than that now, 25, yeah, something like that. I don't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. You probably know.
So
does that make any, I mean, what kind of sense does that make?
All right, so this is very important because remember we started discussing, in our discussion, we said that there are many different ways in which the role of the government is melded together, whether we're talking about deficits in fiscal policy or whether we're talking about the size of government and debts and deficits in general. So this 20% number, as far as I'm concerned, is a totally arbitrary number. There's a belief that government should only account for that part of that size or that fraction, of the economy. There seems to be no rationale mm-hmm. apart from that seems to be a good enough number. Mm-hmm. Why not 10%? Why not 50%? There's no mm-hmm. rationale for it, right? Mm-hmm. Apart from just the simple belief that there is the appropriate size in the U.S. is 20%, right? And that's purely comes purely from Romney's own ideological basis, you know, his own ideological foundations. Now, there are other countries for which the government share of GDP, industrialized countries, is well north of 40%. I don't see.
The government's share in some countries is 40%.
Yeah,
like above. I'm just curious.
So for example, Scandinavian countries, right? They've got much larger shares of their output accounted for by government expenditure, mm-hmm. right?
They're not exactly poor countries either.
They're not poor countries, right? And so this is
standard of living is not noticeably lower in Scandinavia.
Certainly,
than in the United States.
Right. So it becomes really a question of your philosophical underpinnings about the role of government in your life, mm-hmm. right? And we all have different feelings about these things. You know, we for example, might want there to be a provisioning for everybody for healthcare, but may not want the government to be involved in everything. And this is something that's part of the public debate. What mm-hmm. is foolish and I think counterproductive is to talk about gaps like this. Mm-hmm. Right. It's foolish because it's arbitrary, and it's counterproductive mm-hmm. because in some way, what really is important is to have a clear debate about what it is that people mm-hmm. want, mm-hmm. right? And if you kind of forestall that by saying this should be the cap,
right?
It's not at all clear that you're actually increasing the welfare of the
people.
What
you're saying, if I'm understanding you, you're basically saying is that we should start by trying to figure out what kind of a society we want.
Exactly.
And then we should figure out how government can help us, assuming that government can help us, what government can do to help us achieve that society. Yeah. And then we should figure out how to pay for it.
Exactly.
And we shouldn't start by saying, well, we're not going to pay more than 20%.
Right.
And then whatever we can get for that is what we'll have.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think that's exactly right. And it's, you wouldn't run your life like that.
No.
Think about anything that you would. Could you say, I am going to cap my educational loans, no matter what, or my expenditure on education, no matter what, at 4% of my income? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Sometimes you would want more, sometimes you'd want less. It seems like a totally arbitrary kind of conceptualization. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right that it's also not just arbitrary. I actually think it veils a very strong ideological position which is not subject to discussion. Mm-hmm. And I think that really should be subject to discussion. I thought that was what the 99% 1% debate was about. Everything is open for discussion, mm-hmm. right?
So when you say a strong ideological position, I mean, what are you thinking it reveals?
So there is, let's put it like this.
It's getting a little off the economics.
No, that's fine. But I think it's important because it actually informs a lot of the economics that's going on. For whatever peculiar reasons, there's been a large wing, and I would say broadly of the Republican Party, which has been kind of taken over, if you will, by a particular sort of hardcore libertarianism, right? And when I say hardcore libertarianism, it's the idea that government involvement should be literally zero in mm-hmm. your life, Mm-hmm. Now, it's actually I find it interesting, not as a something I would support, but just an interesting sort of set of ideas. How would you try to organize a society when you without too much government involvement? Because for them, the most important freedom, if you will, is the freedom to be left alone from any kinds of external impositions of force. Right? Now,
In particular, property, right? The libertarians are very concerned that they should be able to use their property absolutely without intervention,
exactly.
And nobody should be able to mandate that they have to give any of their property to any purpose.
Exactly, but it applies across the board that one of the things that they're most concerned about is what they would call coercion from coercion from an authority. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, that's interesting, but...
And actually, when you put it that way, it kind of resonates with a lot of occupiers.
Indeed. So I think you did see a lot of people in Occupy, mm-hmm. Bring in some of these ideas. So that's why I treat it with a little more respect than I might otherwise. It is actually an interesting idea. How can you be free of coercion? Some of us, for example, may not want to pay taxes for wars abroad. Mm-hmm. That's an important question, right? Mm-hmm. Having said that, there is the actual question about what governments should be doing and what governments should be spending on, right? The hardcore libertarian edge has come into national politics without any seriousness in the discussion about public policy. So there's been this kind of, if you want to call it a rabble, it sounds disrespectful, but it's really a kind of an energy which wants to reduce government involvement to zero, mm-hmm. right? And that's really an attack of the history of the U.S. since 1930 onwards, and really the history of welfare states in general, right? So that has gotten voice, and I'm not sure Romney personally believes in having zero government involvement or very, very little government involvement. Uh-huh. But he's certainly beholden to the kind of zeitgeist, if you will, the kind of feelings that are there among the base of his party that uh-huh. you have to reduce and maintain the government at a particular level, otherwise it becomes a behemoth and it takes over everything. Uh-huh. And so I think that's what I mean by the uh-huh. ideological struggle.
Well, Romney also... Despite how much he may be beholden to the Tea Party, he also represents directly a class of people that wields a great deal of economic power. And in my sort of view of class politics, the only thing you have to hold against the power of the wealthy, the powerful, the corporations, is the potential of that the people can manipulate the government. Mm-hmm. And manage to balance that power somewhat yeah. through the government. That's government. As much as the government may be corrupt and owned in many ways by the rich and powerful, it's one place where the people can have a voice and they can advance their issues vis-a-vis class politics there. Mm. And so in that sense, arguably Romney has a class interest in small government also, because the weaker the government is, the stronger his class is relatively.
Absolutely. I don't disagree with that at all. So there is the question that once you have a locus of power, like the government, a place where, lots of economic and political decisions get made, that becomes a site in which there's a lot of, you actually have some voice for people who are otherwise not unvoiced, if you will, right, mm-hmm. or who are voiceless. And it is the case with less of that. There's different ways in which their power is reduced. Having said that, what I found most interesting about Occupy was its desire to try and generate not just change through the government, but some sort of different sorts of change, right? Some, collectives in other ways. Mm-hmm. We don't have to necessarily think about the government providing things for us, but let's think about collectives in mm-hmm. a different way. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that energy, we're a year on, just past the anniversary, right? Mm-hmm. And hopefully that energy won't dissipate.
Actually, the anniversary of Occupy Boston is this Sunday.
Okay.
We swear.
So, yeah. All right. So yes, let's hopefully that sort of energy doesn't dissipate. It has dissipated to some extent, but let's rekindle that,
I guess just getting back to the theory a little bit, I just wonder about how you think about fiscal policy and how it relates to increasing globalization of our economy, because this is we're sort of moving from
domestic, yeah,
from the particular back to the theoretical. But I did want to ask this question before we end. Fiscal policy requires a government that can spend, and it requires, you know, policies that can be made and tax. It seems like the global corporations have gotten so powerful and so independent in so many ways, and it's so easy for them to move money and jobs around from place to place. And we often hear, actually, you hear people saying that Keynesianism is dead, and I wonder if this isn't a factor in that kind of thinking. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on how that all works.
Absolutely. So there is a concern that globalization reduces the power of the state to undertake certain activities, right? That is, if the state, for example, tries to spend more and financial interests are worried that they're not going to get their money back, they'll pull out, and interest rates go up, and that hits the government, for example. So there's many stories in which government expenditure might be constrained by globalization. What I think has been very interesting, globalization, particularly of finance, but also in some sense of trade and other in goods and services. But what I think is particularly interesting is, for the case of the U.S., I don't think there has been anything but the opposite effect. And it became very clear that the U.S. was the safest place to put your money in. Money came back from other places during the global financial crisis. Right. So in some sense, I think that
despite their claims for their demands for austerity, some of those investors actually kind of liked the expansionary policies.
Yes, yes, they had a safe place to put their money in. Right. So it is extremely important to realize that the U.S. in some sense, particularly the U.S., is much less constrained than other economies. Right. It's true that other economies, for example, England is much less constrained than Greece.
Greece, because of the European market.
Yes, that's because Britain controls its own currency, whereas Greece doesn't. And Greece perhaps is much more, much less constrained than let's say Mali, right, or a smaller country. So because for each one of these places, they have some degree of policy autonomy, and that depends on their size, their position in the world, and so on. So it is true that globalization reduces the power of some of the states to undertake certain activities, and theoretically, in some countries, it actually reduces it a lot, but not for the U.S. Certainly, there's very little to suggest that globalization currently is preventing the U.S. from spending.
Okay, well, we're actually running out of time. Going to have to wrap up. Do you have any quick thoughts you didn't get out that you'd like to share, or you think we pretty much covered it?
I think we covered it, but I'd also like to, for your listeners, just go back to a point that we made a few minutes ago, that it's a year on, and it would be really good to rekindle some of the spirit which challenges not just simply the kind of reactionary ideas I was speaking about, but the kind of the entrenched interests which Obama and the Democrats and others also represent. And that was, I think, the great power of Occupy, and I hope that in some sense that can be rekindled over the next few years.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%, and we've been talking about fiscal policy with Professor Arjun Jayadev. That's it for tonight's show. Next week, we'll be moving beyond economic theory to talk about the actual federal budget, including an action that many of you can take about the budget on this election day. So join us, same time, Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m. USA Eastern Time, same station, obr.fm on your internet browser dial. The Free School University program you've just heard was originally broadcast on October 3rd, 2012. Join us each Wednesday at 7 p.m. USA Eastern Time on Occupy Boston Radio, obr.fm on your internet browser. Also, check out our blog, fsuradio.wordpress.com, for program information, schedules, and archived programs. Also, our podcast. That's fsuradio.wordpress.com.